Each month, the Security Ledger podcast informs and entertains an audience of thousands of technology and information security professionals. If that sounds like an audience your company is trying to reach, consider sponsoring one of our podcasts. We offer per-episode sponsorships of our weekly podcasts, which feature news, analysis, and discussion of the most important cybersecurity topics of the day. Or you can commission a custom podcast to highlight your executives, researchers, and subject matter experts. To learn more, point your web browser to securityledger.com/sponsor. Hello, you're listening to the Security Ledger podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this episode of the podcast number 192,
disruption starts when you get to the polling place. If you can't register, if you can't be verified, if you can't do all these other things, it causes massive delays, it makes the news, it does all these other things. So that's the first place we look. What's the benefit of disruption?
The 2020 election in the United States is less than a week away, and warnings about cyber threats to the vote are coming out with about the regularity as polls of the presidential contest between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. On October 9th, for example, the FBI and Department of Homeland Security warned that so-called advanced threat actors were chaining together multiple vulnerabilities in an attempt to compromise federal, state, and local government networks and elections organizations. Also this month, an outbreak of the Doppelpaymer ransomware affected elections infrastructure in Hall County, Georgia, disabling a database used to verify voter signatures in the authentication of absentee ballots. Which leads us to ask, despite years of warnings, are state and local governments ready for what Russia, Iran, or any number of for-profit ransomware gangs have in store for them? To help answer that question, we invited Rob Bathurst into the studio. Rob is the Chief Technology Officer at Digitalware, a Denver area company that specializes in risk analysis and risk management for federal, state, and local governments. In this conversation, Rob and I talk about what the biggest cyber risks are to state and local governments and how worried we should be about cyber threats to election systems. To start out, I asked Rob to talk about some of the work the company is doing with state and local governments around election security.
Rob Bathurst, Chief Technology Officer, Digitalware. Digitalware is a firm that specializes in risk analysis and risk management for complex cybersecurity problems. So think state and local government, federal, Fortune 500s. We help them assess and understand that risk, and then how best to fix it and mitigate it.
Okay, and one of the reasons we're talking today, obviously, is we are, you know, third week in October now, and a couple weeks away from a huge national election, federal, state, local races on the ballot here across the country, and a lot of attention in the media to concerns about tampering with election systems. And certainly there's been any number of reports and warnings out from the FBI, CISA, and so on about efforts to infiltrate, you know, local government networks. So what work have you guys been up to, and what have you seen?
We're looking at things like, what is the attack surface of the election system itself? What is the election system composed of? Is it the ballot marking device itself? Is it the e-poll book? Is it the infrastructure? How can they conduct things securely, safely? How does it need to be segmented? So there's a lot of the technical IT architecture and security controls around the election itself. But to your point, the compromises, the issues, the breaches existed before the election, and you know, unfortunately, they will exist after the election. And so the focus has really been, how do we find the things we don't know about that might hurt us during a critical time, either in the municipal infrastructure or during the voting infrastructure itself? Or what can we do about the points that we have to expose? How can we limit the surface from an attack perspective? How can we minimize the opportunity for the attacker? And unfortunately, you know, if that municipal system happens to be breached, how do they isolate the critical parts, the water, the power, the transportation, healthcare-related functions, and the elections from any others? so that they can, you know, minimize potential damage. So we're really seeing a renewed effort around what do we do to protect the voting system? What do we do to isolate it? How do we deal with the complexities of enabling that system for use by the constituents without causing a lot of infrastructure and process that can't really be supported at scale? So it's a lot of, you know, heavy thought that has gone into it. And, you know, being a couple weeks out from the actual event now, a lot of people are in lockdown mode, no changes, no updates to the infrastructure, and really just waiting to see if all that planning has panned out.
When we're talking about elections infrastructure in these communities, these local governments, county governments, generally, what are we talking about? Because I know, obviously, in the information security field and at events, you know, Black Hat and DEF CON, the focus is obviously often on voting terminals, particularly, you know, direct record electronic, DRE, voting machines, that they've been pretty well gone over. But the election infrastructure is actually much more complex than that. What does it involve?
Yeah, it's a great question. So your typical infrastructure, right, for an election or the voting process is broken into kind of three categories. There's the poll book, which they look up the voter themselves, make sure they're registered. If they're not registered, have them fill out a piece of paper or enter some information to get them registered and validated. There's the BMD or the ballot marking device themselves, which in a lot of jurisdictions is paper or a mechanism, no matter how complex or electronic, that's sole purpose is to mark paper and provide an audit trail of the paper ballot itself. And then there's the tally or tabulation system, which is sole responsibility is to count all of those paper votes and upload the results to the state for certification. And so when you look at a small regional government, it's entirely possible that they have almost no electronic mechanism whatsoever other than the tally system, the one that's doing the tabulation of the actual votes. When you look at larger municipalities, when you look at the Bostons or the Chicagos or what have you, it's almost a given that some portion of the infrastructure is going to be connected or in motion at any particular time. That could be the e-poll books or the electronic poll book that might be connected to a clerk and recorder's office that says, hey, is this person allowed to vote at this location? Are they in the right precinct? Does their ID match up? Did it scan correctly? You've got the ballot marking devices, which, as I said, a lot of times are just kind of standalone electronic support systems for the purpose of marking the piece of paper. But in some larger areas, they may be directly connected to a central system for audit. They might be connected to some kind of other system that then connects to the clerk and recorder's backend for a log and event purposes. Unfortunately, there's no consistency in the design and type of system that gets deployed. And then when you get to the tabulation side, again, it varies by county, it varies by region, and especially by state in whether or not that's connected, how it's connected, how the results are uploaded, how that has to be protected. And then to make it even more complex, there's, you know, a little over, I think, a dozen states in the U.S. that have any kind of mandate for certification of any part of an electronic voting process, starting with the e-poll book and then maybe extending to things like ballot marking and tabulation systems.
One of the challenges, obviously, with securing these environments is kind of understanding what the threat is and defining that. And that could go from, you know, nation-state adversaries looking to sow chaos in a U.S. election, undermine public faith in, you know, democratic institutions, to ransomware gangs looking to make a quick buck by causing disruption right around a really important event. Like, as you work with local governments, like, how do you define that? Like, okay, who what are we really worried about here? And then how does that kind of feed through to what you're advising them to do or what changes?
Yeah, that's a great question. You summed it up really well, right? The reality is we're facing a lot of potential threats, a lot of different capabilities, and a lot of different motives inside of the municipal government and election infrastructure that's being targeted. And so one of the first things we always run into when we're talking about the security of an election system is we have to eliminate the sensationalism around some of the press coverage about the known vulnerabilities. People bring up, you know, issues that were found at DEF CON or issues with systems found in 2005 and 2006 or software crashes that were in one of the Carolinas recently. And the fortunate part, I suppose, about the majority of those things is that they're normally bad software development and less likely advanced persistent threat. So a lot of times we have to look at it and say, what does the attack surface of the organization actually look like? What is the benefit of the attacker causing a disruption or potentially getting noticed? You know, because you have to think from the red team perspective, from the adversary perspective, they have a couple different objectives. If you're a ransomware gang, and you're looking at what's the most opportune time to initiate that crypto locker, that Ryuk, whatever it happens to be, is it really going to be right before the election? Is it really going to be after or before, or is it going to give them enough time to pay it? What's the potential response of the local or federal government for doing so? There's a lot of calculations because you have to remember the ransomware gangs are criminals. They're an enterprise. They want money. And so undermining the faith in the election is not their primary objective. Getting paid is. Where you see an interesting interaction in the ecosystem is that in these smaller and mid-sized municipalities and local government systems, is they also can sell access for money, much in the same way that you'd buy credits on Amazon for using cloud compute. And so some of those advanced persistent threats that may want to target and disrupt those, they're going to look for the easiest path to do so, which is probably going to be existing access through one of those implants that a ransomware gang or somebody just happened to get a hold of. And then, again, you have to do the calculation of what's the threat and why are they doing this. If they're going to want to undermine something, taking out that small district in a state in the corner of the U.S. that has a very small population that may or may not make the news, that's not really going to achieve their objective of the information warfare side of things, the psychological perspective. They really need to target larger cities, larger municipalities. And so there's this constant balancing act that if you're a larger municipality, yes, there's a much higher chance you're going to be a target, just like a Fortune 500 company. But you probably also have a lot more advanced infrastructure and a lot more capability to respond and cope with potential attacks. And so when we're advising them, we're really looking at, you know, what's that calculus look like? What would an advanced persistent threat need to do to degrade the confidence in a large city or a large county in that process, in that faith? And that usually comes down to public-facing attack surface, not the ballot marking devices, not the tally systems or the tabulation systems, but really the e-poll book, because disruption starts when you get to the polling place. If you can't register, if you can't be verified, if you can't do all those other things, it causes massive delays, it makes the news, it does all these other things. So that's the first place we look. What's the benefit of disruption? The second place we look is, okay, if the attacker's primary objective is not disruption right now of the election system, but it's to use the distraction of the election to implant themselves in another critical area of that municipality, where might that be? What systems might they wanting to be targeting? What would get them the highest potential payout for disrupting that system? And so we go through and we do that, and we look at the architecture and connectivity between the organization. We do a lot of risk analysis on kind of impact-based pathing. So going through and saying, if an attacker were to get a foothold here, What are the potential paths the attacker could follow? What is the target they want to get to? What is that impact that they may cause? And then how do we start to minimize that? Is it a architecture change? Is it a domain thing? Is it permission? Is it network-based? Is it vulnerability reduction plans? There's a lot of different techniques we can take it in, but it's not a one-size-fits-all for almost any organization.
One of the stories that came out in the last couple of weeks is big security incident at vendor Tyler Technologies that makes a Munis ERP system for local government, very, very widely used. It seems as if, customer data was taken, account information, support accounts and stuff like that, that Tyler staff would use to manage and oversee customer installations. What impact do you think that's going to have just on the overall, security integrity of some of these government networks? And is there reason to be concerned about that?
Well, anytime you get a breach of a vendor that has a large population of customers in the government space, whether it be local, state, or federal, you're always looking at the what model and what mode do they operate in. Are they purely a software vendor where their support accounts are providing access to that local government's data inside of their software platform? Are they a remote support organization that has access to credentials for things like VPNs and other remote access technologies, jump boxes? And then three, you're looking at the how does their software work? Does their software itself provide some kind of remote access? One of the things that Tyler Technologies brought up and some of the other breaches with various technology organizations is a lot of times people don't take into account the what happens if a MSSP or what happens if a hosted or supported technology gets breached in the local government space. What does that give access to? In these municipalities, in these city and county networks, a lot of times they're just flat networks. So if you get into a situation where there is a breach, where something is compromised, where they do get access through that third-party vendor, a lot of times it's a wide-open access point. And that's really the same type of situation we're looking at here is you have a vendor that potentially has access into that government network for support, reasonable support reasons. That is breached, and if those credentials are not quickly invalidated, you're looking at a hanging exposure point. It's out there until they remediate it, until they close it, and then you have to do the after action, the root cause analysis on was data actually breached. If the data was breached, what's the value of it? Does it provide any kind of intelligence to the attacker to better formulate or target that local government? And when you're dealing with ERP systems, given how much data is usually stored in those, I won't speak for Tyler directly, but just kind of in general, those can be very useful for things like targeted phishing campaigns, wire transfer schemes, looking for getting them to execute foothold, execute implant code. There's a lot of different ways that data can be used, not in a direct attack, but to perpetuate a secondary or tertiary type of.
And I know DHS and others have warned recently. I mean, you were talking about VPNs, just about, some comment. I know Pulse Secure had a pretty bad vulnerability. It's still unpatched in a lot of customer sites, and just kind of picking low-hanging fruit in some ways in terms of your preparedness.
Well, yeah, absolutely. VPNs, again, are, when we think about the attacker, everybody likes to picture Hollywood, right? But in reality, they're no different than a IT or security professional working for the other side. And so they're going to leverage the mechanism of least resistance, whether that be a firewall, a load balancer, a VPN appliance, a vulnerability that was exploited in an Outlook that they happened to use for a social engineering effort. And so if there is an organization that they're targeting and they know they're using that Pulse client, if they're using that load balancer, if they're using that firewall at their known execution, their immediate thought process is going to go, is there known publicly available exploit code for this condition? If there is, I'm going to use that. If I do have to use a 0-day to get into this environment because it is that valuable, what do I burn in the process, right? You have to think about it that this isn't, you know, the 80s or 90s anymore where you've got script kiddies just poking around for fun. This is people doing serious business, cost-benefit analysis of, if I do this, what is the, you know, long-term revenue potential or objective degradation that I might have?
You know, one of the big controversies that come up over the years is around the sort of pay the ransom versus don't pay the ransom. Certainly in principle, you support the idea of don't give criminals money. On the other hand, we've certainly seen cases where, you know, municipalities that chose to go that route ended up paying, you know, some multiple of whatever the ransom was to recover their network. So do you see organizations, municipalities wrestling with that question? And what kind of guidance do you give them?
Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunately a question that I think a lot of boards, councils have to come to the realization with, is just like, the do not negotiate with terrorists type of thing we always hear, cliche in the movies. You know, you've got to come to the decision of what's your posture and why. A lot of these organizations, the advice we give them is you could pay if you want to bring the systems back online, but you can't trust the integrity of those systems once they are back online. You can't trust the data that's on them. You can't trust that they won't act as another mechanism for exploitation further into your environment. And so there's an entire plan that has to be put in place that says, you know, what do I look like? What's my posture against a ransomware, especially a self-spreading one, going to look like? How do I contain damage? Do I have completely isolated offline backups, almost like mm-hmm. a two-stage process mm-hmm. where one goes into cold storage? How do I ensure that the ones I put into cold storage haven't been compromised? So there's an entire, hopefully, process we get engaged on in the upfront about how we think about this problem, what the actual outcome is for us. How do we engage people to deal with the breach if there is one? Hopefully there isn't. And then what do we ultimately do about it? The cases I've seen whether they be in the news or through personal experience, where people have paid, it's because they didn't follow those principles, where they had no backup. They mm-hmm. were completely taken offline by the critical system going down. They didn't know what to do. They couldn't even get back to zero. And so the advice we provide is, one, do a lot of homework up front. Make sure you understand what your posture is. Do your tabletops. Look at your risk, you know, your actual risk, your attack surface, and the impacts if an attacker does get in. And then secondarily, the question you have to ask yourself is, if you pay that ransom, you've basically, have I given the attacker greater incentive to come back to the watering hole? You know, because they know I paid, they know I have breach insurance, they know I have all of this other stuff. And so you're basically a repeat customer potentially for them.
It becomes like a protection racket, right?
You know? It absolutely does. It would be a shame if you get your systems encrypted, you know, that type of thing.
It's a nice town you got here. It'd be bad if something happened to it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's I guess the question isn't really do you pay or not pay, but are you in a position to not pay, right? And that's actually the question you need to ask yourself. Do we actually have confidence enough in our process that we cannot pay this, not sort of flipping the coin and say, pay, no, don't pay? You know, it's actually the answer should be fairly straightforward to you. Like, are we even in a position to say, we're not going to pay you?
Right. And what's the net benefit of paying? You know, is great, you have insurance and they're going to pay out, or, you know, you've got some kind of municipal fund that pays out, but was that better than rebuilding from a trusted platform? You know, it's kind of like the old adage when doing incident response is they never let a good crisis go to waste. And so a lot of those times people are not thinking the how do we prevent this from happening in the future, but how do I get out of the news?
Stop the pain.
How do I stop the pain? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so they really need to say does paying actually stop the pain, or is it really just like morphine that the injury is still there? You just can't feel it right now.
We are a couple weeks out from the election. You advise local governments on cyber risk and help them manage their cyber risk. What would your advice be to municipalities out there that might be a little bit fearful going into this final stretch that they might have a bad day or something might crop up in this critical time period? What would you advise them to be on a lookout for, or best practices? As you said, many of them are kind of locked down now. They aren't making changes, at least to the election system. So what's your advice?
So when we're looking at, kind of what's the advice in this near approaching the 11th hour, it's think about the things that are most likely to really cause an impact or to hurt you as an organization. And they're really IT hygiene related. It's, where are my rogue systems? Where are the ones that have those old software? Where do I have firewall or ACL routes inside my organization that give access to critical parts of my environment that may or may not be related to the election system? What they really need to remember is, even if they have an electronic or a mostly electronic election and voting process, is that can be a distraction to let those attackers more easily get to other parts of the environment they might not be looking at. So really focus on the IT hygiene. How's your boundary look? How's your internal segmentation look? Where do you have rogue systems that can provide those potential remediation points, those quick wins? And then just, be vigilant. If something looks odd, it probably is worth looking at and not dismissing, especially given, all of the circus around everything.
Rob Bathurst, Chief Technology Officer at DigitalWare, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Rob Bathurst is the Chief Technology Officer at the firm DigitalWare. He was here talking to us about cyber risks in local government and the cyber risk to elections systems.